Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm your host, Kate Young. Today on our show, we visit the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice at St. Mary of the Woods College in Terre Haute, Indiana. We check in with garden manager Candace Minster about a cucumber study that aims for an early and abundant harvest. Harvest Public Media continues their five-part Snap series with a story about immigration and food assistance. Chef Daniel Orr has an idea for spring radishes. Have you tried pickling them? That's all coming up on our show, so stay tuned. Alex Chambers is away this week, but we have Mark Chilla filling in with the news. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Hey, happy to step in, Kate. So first, on Monday, federal rules took effect that require large chain restaurants, grocery stores, and movie theaters to post calorie counts on their menus. The rule only applies to chains with 20 or more locations, but includes gas stations and convenience stores. The rule was originally slated to take effect in 2015, but was delayed until 2016, and then 2017. And the day before it was supposed to take effect, the Trump administration delayed the rule once more. A review of 28 studies published in the Cochrane Library indicates that labels can reduce the amount of calories consumed by about 12% per meal for those who dine out. Given how empty they are, vacant lots can certainly turn a lot of heads. A collaborative report by NPR's The Salt and the Food and Environment Reporting Network, or FERN, details conflicting interests in vacant lots, particularly among community gardeners and developers in low-income urban neighborhoods across the country. For example, in low-income Brooklyn neighborhood Brownsville, roughly 12 acres of public land are classified as vacant. Functioning community gardens and farms occupy some of that vacant land, providing a source of fresh produce in the area where food resources are lacking. City governments can still label lots as vacant, even if they are occupied by a community farm or garden, leaving them vulnerable to development. But not all development is unwanted. Some of the development in Brownsville's community gardens is slated for affordable housing in the community. A recently completed development plan for Brownsville would add about 2,500 affordable units to the neighborhood, built on dozens of those vacant lots. Historically, people using vacant land for agriculture have not had a voice in its fate. In December 2017, the New York City Council unanimously passed the city's first-ever urban agriculture policy bill, giving neighborhood residents, farmers, and gardeners a say in how vacant lots are developed. And there are numerous examples of collaboration between affordable housing developments and community gardens. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow for those reports, and you can find more at eartheats.org.
Thank you, Mark. It's nice to hear your voice.
No problem, Kate. Anytime.
Federal food benefit programs are vital for low-income immigrant families. But if someone in the household isn't authorized to live in the U.S., the family may not enroll in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or will let their benefits lapse. Esther Honig reports from Colorado on the growing anxiety that enrollment could lead to deportation.
In the small city of Fort Morgan, Colorado, 33-year-old Veronica delicately stacks cans of food into her shopping cart at the local food pantry.
Pues es mucha ayuda para mí. Porque...
She says this pantry has lots of options and helps her keep food on the table.
Leche, huevos, también llevo frutas, verduras.
She shows me her cart piled high with eggs, milk, fruits, and vegetables. Enough food to last about a week.
Somos siete de familia y a veces no me alcanza...
Veronica asked not to be identified by her full name due to the sensitive nature of this topic. SNAP, also known as food stamps, helps her feed her five young children, though it's not always enough. That's why today she's at this pantry called Rising Up. Food pantries may become increasingly important to immigrant communities across the country. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says about 4 million children who are citizens but whose parents are unauthorized immigrants receive SNAP benefits. Their parents are not eligible without some form of legal status. Advocates say families with unauthorized immigrants are wary to share information with a government agency in order to enroll in SNAP.
Hola, mi nombre es Anya. Gracias por llamar a Colorado Sin Hambre. ¿Cómo le puedo ayudar?
Anya Rose helps run Hunger Free Colorado's food resource hotline. She talks with unauthorized immigrants every day.
I think that we are seeing more people afraid to apply for food stamps or deciding not to recertify or ending their benefits, even though they might be eligible.
Rose says the Trump administration, which supports policies targeting unauthorized immigrants, has stoked fear among families. They worry their personal information could be shared with other government agencies like Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Rose tells them their SNAP application is confidential and that these benefits will ensure they don't go hungry. But some families won't risk it.
They might say, I hear you, but I'm just not going to engage with this. It doesn't make sense for me or my family.
In the meantime, Rose refers them to local food pantries, like Rising Up.
Lots of times we see people that are just trying to get started and to get by, and so that's where we try to help them.
Pam Hernandez is the director and says the pantry serves 300 families a year, and many come to the area to work at a factory, like the Cargill meatpacking plant. She says the majority of people who come in are also on SNAP, and although clients are asked for proof of local residence, she's not worried whether they're authorized to live in the U.S.
The thing is, if you're hungry, we're here to help you.
After 49-year-old Aurelia lost her job in January, she started shopping at the pantry. She's also on SNAP and volunteers here to satisfy some of the program's work requirements. She asked that we not use her full name because she has relatives who are unauthorized immigrants. Aurelia knows of many families who would rather go hungry than take the risk of signing up for SNAP.
Sí, muchas veces sí pasa eso.
Like many pantries, Rising Up doesn't track how many clients are unauthorized immigrants. Hernandez suspects they don't get very many, but...
We always make it a point to let people know that it's not all about the paperwork.
She's confident that if families need help, they'll feel safe coming here. Aurelia has lived in this community for 22 years and says the unauthorized immigrant population has feared deportation before, like during a raid at a dairy here 7 years ago.
Sí, hay temor, claro que hay temor en toda la comunidad, ¿verdad? Pero...
But Aurelia says she and other immigrants came here to work, and they're not going anywhere. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
That story is part of a five-part series on SNAP, produced by Harvest Public Media. Find more at harvestpublicmedia.org. A few weeks ago, I headed out to the White Violet Center for Ecojustice at the Sisters of Providence of St. Mary of the Woods in Terre Haute, Indiana. I wanted to find out how this cold, wet spring has been affecting the start of the growing season in Indiana. And I wanted to hear more about a cucumber grafting study I'd heard about. Candace Minster was the one to talk to. She's the garden manager at White Violet, and honestly, to call it a garden is a bit misleading. It's more like a small-scale farm. They've got 5 acres of certified organic gardens, a couple of acres of fruit trees, plus they raise alpacas for wool and chickens for eggs. The garden provides the Sisters of Providence with fresh produce. They also run a CSA, sell at the farmer's market, and stock a newly opened farm store on site. The center also serves as an educational space and in some cases a place for research. I met with Candace out in the garden on a damp and cloudy day in late April. She said everything was behind schedule, with the ground so wet they couldn't till the beds for planting. But rain wasn't the only problem.
When the cold weather persists for so long, the plants that are outside are under a lot of stress. And so they tend to not put on a lot of growth. And then they can also be damaged in those freezes that are coming along a little later. So the garlic that has popped quite high by now, I mean, those babies have been mulched down quite a bit, but there's the growth is so high, and then when the freeze comes along, the tissue, the plant tissue gets damaged. They'll survive, but we have to go through and pull that damaged tissue off as the fresh greens start to grow, because it can malform the garlic.
You're talking about a hard freeze as opposed to frost.
Right, right. A lot of the spring crops can tolerate some frosts, but it was the combination of the actual freeze, the hard freeze, as well as the rains. So we've had some really intense rainstorms here where we've gotten quite a bit of rainfall in a short period of time, and then when something like the peas, it washes the peas right out. So they then you lose that crop.
And so has it also just delayed you from, like, would you be further along in planting or in prepping?
Yes. Yeah. At this point, we would have all of those coal crops in the field, all the broccoli, all the cabbage, and definitely it's delayed the transplanting and the overall field production. We're behind schedule for sure. We've been bumping up against rain, and one of the things I learned when I moved to this area of Indiana is if it rains on Easter Sunday, the next 7 Sundays will be wet. And I have to say that has been so accurate in my experience since I've been here.
Hey, it didn't rain last Sunday.
It didn't. That's right. Well, it snowed on Easter for us here. So
that's a whole different set there.
All bets are off. Who knows what that means?
Ah, the life of a farmer, always at the mercy of the weather. Some things never change. You might have heard of tree grafting, where the upper part of, say, a peach tree with an especially sweet fruit is grafted to the rootstock of a type of a tree that's known to grow well in that particular area. It's a pretty common practice. After a short break, we'll head into the hoop house for a look at a grafted cucumber project. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step, New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Kate Young, you're listening to Earth Eats, and we're back with Candace Minster, the garden manager at the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice.
So we can walk up to the tunnel, the height tunnels, and take a look at the cucumber plants.
Okay, that sounds great.
This one, I'm keeping it closed. Generally, we would have the tunnels open. It's about 54, 55 right now, and it's overcast, but that's plenty warm enough for the cool crops that we have. However, inside this tunnel, we have a grafted cucumber study that we're doing with Purdue University. So these cucumbers don't like to be cold, so I'm trying to baby them along a little bit, so we'll go inside. already feel the difference.
Yeah. Smells so good in here. It smells so earthy and...
So these are the cucumbers, and we're growing two beds of cucumber plants, and we have three varieties. And for each variety, we have grafted plants and non-grafted plants. We're growing them on a trellis, and we'll train the plants to grow up the trellis, and that's a really great tip for anybody. Even in a home garden, you can really maximize your space by trellising your cucumbers up rather than letting them sprawl on the ground, and your cucumbers will stay cleaner and get less insect damage that way. This is our second year doing a study. The researcher, her name's Wenjing Guan, and she's originally from China, and her area of specialty is in grafted vegetables. And tomatoes have been the superstar of the grafted world for the last few years. And now there's a little bit more in the melon industry, but cucumbers, not so much. So Wenjing's part of a pretty new project, really, seeing if grafted cucumbers can provide a benefit for organic growers. So specifically, what she's doing is taking the top of the, which is called the scion, of the cucumber plant that is the desirable plant that you want to have to harvest. So this Taurus cucumber is kind of a longer style, like an English style cucumber, not huge seeds. And then the root stock is actually a winter squash. And so the little squash plant is grown, and then the little cucumber plant is grown, and then you decapitate that poor little squash and you cut that top of that little cucumber, and then you join the two together, and you can use a little clip that will hold the two tissues together. So here's one of them. And the interesting thing about these is as the plant grows, it will shed the clip. So it's not so tight that it's going to cause tissue damage.
So this sounds like an incredibly delicate process. When I think of a cucumber stem or a squash stem, I think of this hollow, watery, delicate thing, and especially as a seedling.
Yes, it is. So as part of her study, Wenjing is doing some ongoing education around cucumber grafting and just really grafting in general. So she invited us to go to the Purdue University Research Center outside of Vincennes, Indiana, and see the grafting process and learn about it and even attempt it. And it is very, very delicate. What she's been looking at are the Persian style cucumbers or English cucumbers, the seedless varieties, the ones that can get a little higher dollar value on the wholesale market or even from a regular retail market at the farmers market. There are a lot of different factors that you can study for when you are looking at grafted plants, and she's specifically looking at productivity and the early seasonality. So the idea behind having them grafted onto the squash rootstock is that the squash is more cold tolerant than the cucumber is. So she's trying to determine if that squash rootstock will help pass on some of that cold hardiness to the cucumber plant. And then also, as the growing season is underway and we're harvesting, we track the weight that we get off of the cucumbers, and we also track how many fruit come off of each plant. And then that will, and then of course running a comparison of the grafted to non-grafted to see which ones perform the best. There's a lot of record keeping and you know, keeping track of everything as we go through the season.
And that's something you're doing here, not the researcher.
That's correct. So I already track when we harvest how much of what we harvest. We tend to stick to the same few people that we'll harvest in here, so, because we're familiar with it. And then that way we can keep the data pretty clean for Wenjing, because we want this to be beneficial for her research.
one of the things that is hoped for is cold tolerance. Mm-hmm. Could it impact how many fruit you would harvest from each plant? Like that's mm-hmm. a little less obvious to me.
Yes. So we noticed last year was the first time we did this, and we noticed with a couple of the varieties that the grafted plants did have a little higher yield. What was interesting to me was that the non-grafted plants were the first to fruit, but the grafted plants, even though they didn't fruit as quickly, produced more and over a little longer period of time. So we did see a marked difference in one of the other varieties that we had last season of the performance of the grafted to the non-grafted.
So you would not normally be starting a really warm weather crop like that in here right now. Is that correct?
That's correct. Right. So everything else that's in here is we have lettuce, carrots, radishes, spinach, arugula. It's all cool, season tolerant things.
So now I look at them. So these are the.
So these are, this side are not grafted, and this side, these are grafted.
These are the grafted ones?
Yes.
Okay.
So if we get down and if you look at the soil level, just above the soil level, you'll see this bump.
Yep.
And that is the grafting join. So right down here, this is the squash, and then this is where the cucumber begins.
Well, I can see just from the naked eye that mm-hmm. these are taller. Mm-hmm. They're further along, and it looks like they're fruiting.
Yes, they are. And
or making blossoms or something.
They are. Well, yeah, and I've been picking off some of the first fruit, those baby fruit, and as we were pinching some of these off. This is what we do around here. We're like, I wonder if this part is edible. I wonder what this tastes like. And we discovered that these little teeny, teeny baby fruit are really tasty.
Wow. Okay. I have tried to eat a cucumber sprout. Mm-hmm. Not good.
Yeah.
Tastes really bad. Really bitter.
Yeah. Yeah. But the little tiny baby fruit are pretty good. So you can eat that little guy.
I will try it. That's great. That's really good. Tastes like a cucumber.
Yeah.
Little mini one, compact. In case you are wondering why she would pinch off the little cucumbers when the whole point is to get early fruit production, it's because late April is too early for the plants to set fruit. These guys were just transplanted into the soil, and they'd been waiting in pots a bit too long, again, with the cold spring. So they're stressed. Stressed plants set fruit. It's a survival mechanism. Candace wants the plants to be stronger and healthier before they set their fruit, so she's delaying that a bit by pinching them off. I got Wenjing Guan on the phone to ask about her study. I asked what was most exciting to her about this research.
Most exciting moment is like this morning I was with a farmer I'm collaborating with, and he has the grafted cucumbers and the normal cucumbers planted in end of March this year. And this morning I'm standing in the field with him. We saw the normal cucumbers probably only 10 to 20% survived, and all the grafted plants, they all survived. That's very exciting.
Planting cucumbers in the ground in March, in Indiana, especially in a cold spring like we've had, that is quite an accomplishment. Wenjing says the next phase is to teach farmers to graft their own seedlings so they can continue to reap the benefits even after the study is complete. We'll check back in with Candace at White Violet later in the season to see how her grafted cucumbers are coming along. Now, there is one crop that does do well in a cold spring season, and that's radishes. Early spring is their time to shine. Chef Daniel Orr has an idea for what to do with a bumper crop of radishes.
I'm going to show you a recipe that my friend Mihoko taught me how to make when I was living in New York City and had a rooftop penthouse garden. So this is a sun-pickled radish, and she did it with the daikon radish. Daikon is this big radish you can see here. It's a white radish, very, very mild. So you can use that, and that's what I traditionally use. But this year at Kolb Homestead, our farm, we're getting all these little long radishes. And these are 2.5 to 3 inches long, red, really, really pretty. What you do is you take your radishes, and I put them in a plastic container, and you've cut the tops off of them. Okay, now we're going to put quite a bit of salt. For about 20 radishes, we have about 1/4 cup to 1/2 cup of salt. And we're just going to rub that salt into the radishes. And this is going to help the salt permeate the radish and start drawing out the liquid. And then you're just going to spread them out again. And then you're going to go put this in the sunniest part of your yard. Now, things happen outside that don't happen inside, like bird flyovers and things like that. So what I always do is put a piece of cheesecloth on top or put a piece of screen on top so nothing can go in there. And you leave them out there for about 10 days to 2 weeks. And what you get is, I've got some that we did. And you can see how they've shriveled up, dried up. Then what you do is you finish it. Some rice wine vinegar, some sugar, and some ginger. Now they've soaked up all the salt that you're really gonna need. And then if you want to make them spicy, you could put some crushed red pepper flakes on there too. These will last a long time. Now you could put them in a jar, keep them in the fridge. But they have that kind of sauerkraut, salty preserved flavor. But these are great. I serve these chopped up fine on top of my pea soup. So it would be more of a condiment type of pickle. Be great to have with plain steamed rice. So it's just another interesting way to preserve food, and I learned it from my good friend Mihoko from Japan.
And you can learn it from Chef Daniel Orr. The recipe is on our website, eartheats.org. I do hope you enjoyed our show this week, and we'd love to hear from you. Get in touch by emailing eartheats@gmail.com. Leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Twitter @eartheats. Support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at PersonalFinancialServices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Earth Eats would not be possible without Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Candace Minster and Wenjing Guan. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. Thanks for tuning in to Earth Eats.